The experience of anxiety has captured people's attention for millennia. From ancients like Hippocrates to icons like Freud, the feeling of overwhelming dread, fear, or nerves has been as perplexing as it has been common.
Today, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health problem in the United States. At 40 million diagnoses, it's something that almost 20% of adults will experience. While it might be widespread, it's not something that people always feel comfortable talking about.
Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic magazine, chose to share his personal experience with anxiety in his new book called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. A successful author and journalist, Scott's description of debilitating dread and phobia has struck a chord with readers across the country and has been what he describes as a coming-out experience. Scott's here with us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've suffered from anxiety attacks for years, and to start sort of at square one, for people who are lucky enough not to know what panic attacks feel like, can you describe what it's like for you?
Sure. I mean, they can vary a little bit, but fundamentally, it is as though your brain and your body has been hijacked by the fight or flight response. I mean, in effect, it's kind of, in some ways, it's an evolutionarily adaptive response, the feeling of the fight-or-flight response, which Darwin and early doctors like Walter Cannon identified, that, you know, prepares you to run away from a saber-toothed tiger that's attacking you, or to fight if an enemy tribe. But when it comes on spontaneously in the form of a panic attack, or an attack that's triggered by some phobic stimulus, it's this sort of awful panoply of cognitive symptoms where your thoughts start racing and you can't think and you can't concentrate and things sort of seem unreal. And then what's worse for me often are the physical symptoms where you can start sweating uncontrollably and trembling and even, you know, shaking quite violently, and you have gastric distress and you get dizzy and you get tingling in your hands and feet, and you can have a whole range of other symptoms. And many people, you know, the first time that it happens to them, they think that maybe they're having a heart attack and end up rushing to the emergency room only to be told that they're happily just having an anxiety attack. But even though it's, you know, benign compared to a heart attack, it's not in itself physically dangerous. It can be terrifying while you're experiencing one.
Well, and you had one at an especially bad moment. I mean, I'm sure there have been many bad moments, because there's never a good moment to have a panic attack, but you had one at your wedding. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. I mean, it was, and this was, there's what's known as kind of spontaneous or internally cued panic attacks, which happen where you don't actually know what's triggering them, or sometimes, you know, it's some unconscious thought or some physiological blip in your body. In this case, it was triggered concretely by the fear of standing in front of, you know, the 300 or so guests that we'd invited to our wedding who were coming to watch us get married. And, you know, it was very, very hot in the wedding, so I was already in the church. It was July, so I was already sweating a little bit. And as my wife is sort of walking down the aisle, you know, the sweat is starting to drip and drip and flow. And, you know, my thought process is, oh, my God, you know, you start to develop the fear of the fear. This is a very common phenomenon of many anxiety disorders, and particularly panic disorder, where you become afraid of the fear itself. And that's what happened in this instance. And it very quickly sort of cycles out of control, where I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to be humiliated. Everyone's looking at me. They can see that I'm sweating. This means I'm not suitable. You know, all the thoughts that they've had about how I'm not worthy of my wife-to-be are being confirmed. And then, you know, I can see the minister looking at me. And I think in my head, I'm probably at the time was overestimating what other people's responses are. In fact, you know, a characteristic of anxiety is that you tend to be very inward focused and, you know, kind of unhelpfully narcissistic. But eventually my symptoms got so bad that, you know, my best man is handing me a Kleenex to try to wipe my sweat, and the minister is kind of looking down at me and mouthing quietly, like, are you okay? And my wife is literally physically having to hold me up because I'm shaking.
Oh, boy.
And, and then by that point, I'm not really present in the moment, and it's just sort of horrifying. And then afterwards, you feel this kind of self-loathing for having, you know, messed up what should have been, you know, one of the most important moments of my life, and, you know, ruined it for both me and my wife, although we've gotten long past that now.
Well, and at least it's comforting, or maybe it's not, but you're not alone in this. Can you tell us about how widespread panic disorders, anxiety is for people in this country and beyond?
Well, the collectively, the anxiety disorders, and that's, you know, the set of different diagnoses as defined by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, they are post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD, panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and simple phobia. And the sort of distinctions between those are not always clear cut. But basically, altogether, probably one in six adult Americans are estimated at some point to will suffer from an anxiety disorder for some period of time. And then there, you know, it ranges in its degree. There are people who are so anxious that they are housebound for years and are unable to function and can't work in a workplace. There are other people like me who are most of the time, you know, quite high functioning. Particularly people with panic disorder, for whatever reason, it's part of the kind of character, characterological characteristics of it that they often are very good at hiding it. When, you know, when you're not actually having a panic attack, you're at great pains to try to conceal what you believe is the sort of anxious, embarrassing, shameful person within. And so you do that by projecting an outward presence of calm, competence. So as you mentioned at the top of the show, I'm 44 years old. I, in effect, you know, stayed in the closet about this for most of my life, you know, even though I'd spent years enduring different kinds of therapies, and people very close to me knew. And I always sort of thought that some other people must suspect a little bit, but I was shocked when early copies of the book started circulating, and I had colleagues coming into my room in my office saying, you know, we just had absolutely no idea. So it's quite possible to conceal these things very effectively. And, you know, part of what I'm doing by... I didn't set out to do this, but in effect, I'm realizing that by writing this book and now being open about this, I'm hoping to sort of diminish some of the stigma attached to anxiety disorders and to mental illness more generally, and to demonstrate to people that, A, if you feel this way, you're not alone. There's help for you. There's plenty of other people who suffer, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an impediment to having an effective life.
Since you have kind of put this out there for everybody to know, your colleagues and, you know, the whole world, do you feel like your anxiety has gotten less? Or if you're in a position where you do feel anxious, you know, at any moment you can say, you know, you'll have to excuse me, I'm having some anxiety right now, and then maybe that might calm things down.
That's a very interesting question. I've thought about it a lot, and the jury is still out, I guess, is the short answer. But I mean, the irony is, I kind of conceived the idea of writing this book 10 years ago when I was in, you know, quaking dread of my first book tour. And now, you know, I ended up spending, you know, 6 or 7 years writing this book, and now here I am rewarded with another book tour. what I'm hoping that the difference is this time is, A, you know, I have more practice, but also, as you just said, you know, I feel like if at some point I were to have to walk off stage or, you know, hang up on you during this radio show, I or you could just say, well, refer to chapter 4, and you'll understand exactly what's going on. But so in that respect, it has been somewhat liberating, and also just the number of people, both people that I know and some celebrities actually, and then far more people I don't know, strangers just writing in to say, thank you, you know, this has been so helpful to me, you know, it sort of helps to salve the shame component of it. On the other hand, though, you know, one component of people who have kind of aspects of social anxiety disorders, what you fear is having people scrutinize you carefully. And so, and this is the, you know, nature of my nutty, anxious mind, is that now when I go out there, even though I'm aware I can, maybe it's not such a horrible thing if I just say, sorry, I'm having a panic attack or an anxious moment, but I'm always wondering, okay, are people noticing, are they looking extra closely to see a sweat beating on my lip? Is my voice quivering? Am I, starting to shake visibly? So I'm sort of inviting the kind of scrutiny that, I'm most terrified of. But I suppose in the fullness of time, that could prove to be very good exposure therapy, which is what many phobias call for.
Right, so it can be a kind of a loop. Well, let me tell you, if you hang up on this interview, I'm totally fine with it. I've had panic attacks myself, and I know where you're coming from, and lots of artists have had them as well. Do you think it's part of having a creative life, being someone who is more sensitive and prone to anxiety?
There's been a lot written about that, going back to Aristotle, who, you know, postulated that there was some connection between creativity and mental illness of various kinds. And it's not fully provable, but there's a woman actually at the University of Iowa named Nancy Andreessen, who's a neuroscientist, and she's been studying, you know, what makes super creative people that way, and she's looking at both kind of literary writers and artists, and also people in fields like physics and economics, and, you know, what are the sources of their great creativity. And interestingly, there was much less correlation between high IQ and this sort of creativity than there was between when she would look at their brains in an MRI machine. It showed they were using a more disparate part of their brain. You know, they're sort of associating, you know, drawing on more different parts of the brain. And interestingly, that seems to be also correlated with various forms of mental illness. And when she looked at the families of the people that she studied, it turns out that even if some of these artists and economists weren't themselves mentally ill, they had a much higher percentage of relatives than average with mental illness, which suggests that there is some correlation in some way that we don't fully understand yet between mental illness of various kinds and creativity. With anxiety, I think, in particular, it can, you know, it can be a motivator because you're always trying to outrun your fear of failure, but also you have acute social antennae. I mean, I talk a lot with my sister, has a also struggles with anxiety, particularly of a social sort, and she calls it her talking problem. And she gets into a social situation, and she's extremely intelligent, but she'll sort of freeze up and be unable to think of what to say because she's so worried about what the other person is thinking mm-hmm. about her, and she sees them stifling a yawn or a twitch of disdain. And the truth is that psychologically healthy people may have an adaptively blunted perception of reality, that socially anxious people may be so good at picking up on these subtle social cues that are in fact there, but that you're better off just not noticing. So that could translate too into things that, you know, help with creative arts and other things.
We're talking right now with Scott Stossel about his new book, My Age of Anxiety, in which he explores his personal experience with debilitating anxiety.
And we want to hear from you. Have you experienced anxiety? Were you able to overcome it? How does it affect your daily life? And do you have questions for Scott about his experience? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at some of the latest news with reporter Kristen Durst.
Federal prosecutors have escalated their criminal investigation into allegations that Governor Chris Christie's aides created traffic jams as political payback. Subpoenas have been issued for his reelection campaign and the state Republican leadership. A lawyer who represents the campaign says the subpoenas seek documents related to the closure of traffic lanes near the George Washington Bridge. Law enforcement officials say threatening phone calls prompted an alert at Colorado's Columbine High School for a time today. In 1999, two students opened fire at Columbine, killing 12 classmates and a teacher, and wounding 26 others before killing themselves in the school's library. School received the first phone call at 10 a.m., and others came over the next 2 to 3 minutes. The lockout was lifted after 2 p.m. Governor Scott Walker has called a special session of the legislature to consider his $500 million property and income tax plan. Walker announced his special session today, one day after he detailed his plan during his State of the State speech. For Central Time, I'm Kristen Durst.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
Wait a second. I thought I lived in a democracy. I thought that I had rights. But most of those rights, or many of them, have been taken away from us, or we voluntarily have handed them over.
I want these kids off of my lawn, and I want it to stop sleeting and snowing. Those are the only two things that I ask right now.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Contributors to WPR include Hooper Corporation, providing electric power and mechanical construction services to commercial, industrial, renewable energy, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back now with Scott Stossel talking about his new book, My Age of Anxiety, in which he shares his personal experience with debilitating anxiety.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What is your experience with anxiety been? What has worked? Were you able to overcome out the other side of it? Or is it something that just keeps coming back over and over? And why do you think anxiety is running rampant in our culture today? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to the phones right now. We'll go first to Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good evening.
Hello.
My question is, I've been dealing with, I was originally, I guess they told me I was clinically depressed. Then I was labeled with OCD. And I guess off and on through my life, and I'm almost 50 now, but I still regularly have panic and, phobia-stemmed panic attacks, but situational phobia or situational anxiety. And I'm wondering if there's anything, I know like you talked about actually some of the stuff, just being able to, or getting out and doing the stuff.
Sounds like you're wondering what works.
What works? I mean, I'd rather not be on a antidepressant or anti-anxiety for the rest of my life.
All right, well, let's see what our guest has to say. And I know, Scott, that you have pretty much tried it all. What would you say to someone like Jeff who's looking for some relief?
Well, I have tried many, many things, and I have to say candidly that nothing has cured me. But there are many things, both from my own experience and from my extensive reading, that I can say can be very helpful. And you know, let me say up front that I'm not a physician, and that a physician is always the best person to make these kind of recommendations. But there are a whole host of both ways of taking care of yourself and also therapies that you can seek. And you mentioned medication. I mean, I have relied often on and, mostly on over the course of, some 30 years, many different classes of medication. And some of them have worked for me some of the time very effectively. But, Jeff is right that there's still astonishingly little knowledge about how exactly they work, what the long-term effects on our brains are. A lot of them have debilitating side effects and can create dependency. And so, and there are many people too, therapists and critics of the drug industry, who will say, actually all you're doing with drugs is treating, you're masking the symptoms. You're not really treating the underlying anxiety. I think there may be something to that, but for me and for many, many other people, benzodiazepines and antidepressants, benzodiazepines being sort of like Xanax and Klonopin, which are an anti-anxiety medication, can be very effective at reducing the physical symptoms. One form of therapy that much of the literature is focusing on now and that is showing to be, as effective, if not more so than medication, with fewer side effects and maybe longer lasting effects, is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And basically that's a form of talk therapy where you work with a therapist to expose yourself to the things that you fear, including panic attacks, stimulating them artificially if you can, and then learning that you can cope with them and changing your thought processes so they don't go running down these negative, a lot of people with anxiety tend to have very negative thought patterns that they cycle into, and CBT can help cancel that out. Another thing that I have not that I'm actually quite hopeful about for myself and haven't given enough of a shot, because I'm struck by the powerful accounts in the literature, and that's various forms of meditation. And this is something that comes from the East, but what they now call mindfulness meditation, which is just kind of, they're all different kinds of meditation, but it's basically sort of accepting the anxiety and doing focused breathing work. And the most interesting study to me is they had a bunch of novice meditators just do a short course of learning how to meditate. And after like a month, they interviewed all these meditators, and they all reported, or almost all of them reported, that they had higher levels of well-being, lower levels of anxiety. And then they put them in an fMRI machine where you can look at their brain, and they actually saw that literally the size of their amygdala, which is the sort of seat of fear in the brain, mm-hmm. had shrunk, and the density of neuronal of connections in the front of the brain had increased. So here's clear kind of Western empirical evidence that an Eastern technique works. And
now,
then,
Scott, you said you had tried that, or you haven't yet?
I have, in a kind of half, not serious enough way. I've done various kinds of meditation, and it does help. I mean, breathing, when you're in a panicky moment, or if you're in situational anxiety, learning how to do the right kind of breathing can actually help calm your physiology. And of course, the irony is, the more anxious you are, the harder it is to have that take effect and work effectively. But just two other things that are actually, based from my own personal experience and from reading, getting it, and this sounds like stuff that your mother or grandmother have told you, but get enough sleep. There's the amount of evidence about sleep deprivation and anxiety is like becoming, greater and greater. And of course, it can become a cyclical thing, because if you're anxious, you have insomnia, and if you have insomnia, then you have worse anxiety, and that can kind of cycle out of control. And get regular exercise. Again, okay. That's good for your physical health.
Sleep and exercise. I'm just going to jump in there because we have so many people who want to talk
sure
to
thing.
You, and we're running out of time. So let's go to Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi, Lynn, you're next. And oh, Jeff, thank you for calling, and good luck to you. Appreciate that call. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I was calling because I wonder how many people are highly sensitive people, as they call it, in New Agey, they call it empaths. People who just are kind of overwhelmed by sensations and feelings of other people, and that translates into anxiety. So like an empath or a highly sensitive person literally can feel other people's kind of feelings, and it gives them anxiety. So I guess what I'm saying is I would assume that people who have anxiety, there's a different root causes for people. And I think that identifying those highly sensitive people and giving them tools for how to deal with that might help some people who have anxiety.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn. That's a good point. And highly sensitive people, it sounds as though that could have some correlation there with anxiety. So, Scott, what do you know about that? And do we even have a handle on where anxiety comes from?
Well, there actually is a scale called the ASI, or Anxiety Sensitivity Indicator, and it sort of relates to what that caller was just saying. And it's precisely that anxious people tend to be much more overwhelmed by all kinds of sensations, whether that's inputs from the world or things going on within their own bodies. They are just more sensitized. And again, that can be maybe what leads to creative gifts in some folks, but it can often lead to just physical unpleasantness in a lot of others. And learning how to control that, whether through meditation, exercise, medication, taking care of yourself is important at tamping that down.
All right. And Scott, as you go along and you've had this big journey and you're still in the middle of it, what advice would you give people who are going through crippling anxiety sometimes? We've got about a minute left.
Well, first of all, if you're in dire distress, seek help from either your family physician, or there's an organization that's a nonprofit called the ADAA, which is the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, and they don't represent any single point of view. They're completely ecumenical in their approach, and they will just give you information about anxiety and can help hook you up with a therapist if that's what you want. But basically what I was saying earlier, take care of yourself, seek help if you're in severe distress, and know that, you are not alone. There are 40 million of us out there in the U.S. Now, then there's the rest of the world. And one of the things that I've found most consoling about working on this book is that I found all these characters throughout history, from Sigmund Freud and William James and Charles Darwin, who sort of were motivated by their own anxious struggles to, seek new theories of mind, to, all kinds of doctors and great men and women from deep into history. So this is, it's part of the human condition, and it has redeeming qualities too, that, so when you're feeling miserable, recognize that there are gifts that may come with your anxiety as well, as debilitated as you may feel.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for talking about this openly.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Scott Stossel, editor of The Atlantic Magazine and the author of My Age of Anxiety.